Está aceito. Perfeito. Azul, can you read the statement, please? We got the slides.
Oh, you want me to read the statement?
Yes. Yes,
I
please.
I prefer that you have a very nice way of reading.
No preferences at all, Azul.
You be the speaker. I think that was the actual
No, Andre has a very, like, a voice which, you know, makes me believe that I must, follow what he says, kind of thing.
So,
all right, no worries. Let me just give me. You want me to read the statement? I'll definitely do that.
Obligatory.
All right. So we are on 26th May. Let me just share my screen, and we are ready to start. Okay. Okay, so welcome this afternoon. This morning, if you're tuning in from Europe, afternoon, if you're tuning in from Asia Pacific, Japan, 26th of May, for the Trade Finance Specialist Interest Group call. Antitrust policy, and which I must read as part of the code of conduct of this Trade Finance SIG. So Linux Foundation meetings involves participation by industry competitors, and it is intention of Linux Foundation to conduct all of its activity in accordance with the applicable antitrust and competition laws. It is therefore extremely important that attendees adhere to the meeting agendas and be aware of and not participate in any activity that are prohibited under applicable US, state, federal, or foreign antitrust and competition laws. Example of type of action that are prohibited at Linux Foundation meetings and in connection with Linux Foundation activities are described in the Linux Foundation antitrust policy available at http://www.linuxfoundation.org/antitrust-policy. If you have questions about this matter, please contact your company counsel, or if you are a member of Linux Foundation, feel free to contact Andre Abdegrove of the firm Gessmer Abdegrove LLP, which provides legal counsel to the Linux Foundation. With that, I would like to forward it to Andre to announce the agenda for today. Andre, over to you to announce the agenda and the speaker. Andrew, can you hear me, or you want me to announce Pom?
He's on mute. Andrea, you're on mute.
Okay. I think he's on mute, so I'll continue. So for today, we have Pom from UK. He's going to talk about his perspective on how trade and trade finance has evolved, and he has written multiple different papers, and he's going to talk through today with his insight into what he has seen in the market, provide some wisdom, provide some thought-provoking ideas, which, you know, I'm excited to listen to, as well as, you know, all of us here in the call would be very excited to hear from Pom, who is a leading authority in the blockchain space. So with that, over to you, Pom, and I will flash your slides. Just let me know when you're ready.
Super, thank you very much, Atul, and welcome everybody, and thank you for having me on your special interest group to share thoughts and insights on trade finance, and more specifically with trade in mind too. Atul, thank you for putting up this please note slide from IBM. Again, I won't be reading this as you have done, but if you do take a second or two to glance through this, this will be good, because during this session, what I'll aim to do is just share with you some insights based upon some recent data that we released, based upon some research last week, which provides real evidence now as to how trade and trade finance really now needs to evolve, despite all the best efforts in place to help digitize trade and trade finance to make markets more efficient. And more efficiency means lower cost, because we have seen the reports that says that the lower the cost of trade, then the more likelihood there is that trade will grow. One thing, as we're all in this COVID-19 world, has shown that the processes within global trade finance and global trade are stressed, to the extent that goods are stuck in ports, they're not moving because of paperwork and the inefficiencies within the system. And therefore, those processes and those best endeavored efforts need help. However, we are living in a complex global world, and there are dynamics in force, which I'll cover very shortly. But it does sort of pose the question, is there now a more an efficient way that the market infrastructure could be optimized to allow for what was now really the trusted and transparent movement of data across those processes to enable trade and trade finance to occur? And what, as a result of COVID-19, could help establish what could be this new norm? However, as I run through some of the content here, it does ask a bigger question. Is there an onus now on everybody involved in the trade ecosystem to work in a slightly different way if we really want the economy to recover? And the recovery is GDP growth. And GDP growth is linked to trade growth, which is where the costs and the inefficiencies are still too high. So with this data, I'll be sharing with you research from in three sections, in as far as the initial responses to how use of blockchain to provide trust and transparency is actually now coming out of the trough of disillusionment. The second piece is then what companies who are responding to the research that we put forward late last year and published just last week are expecting to help trade to be digitized and trade finance to be enabled in a much more efficient way. And then also, how do they want to now operate in what could be this new market infrastructure and this new marketplace? Next slide, please, Atul. So just to set the scene a little bit, and we'll start off on effectively from the bottom left of the slide. His trade is complex. There's no two ways about it. If you look at it politically with what's happening between China and the US, what's happened in the UK with Brexit, it's a complex environment where the quotas and the tariff negotiations are fraught with tension and other motivations. We do have, though, industries and industry bodies trying to facilitate those trade enablement capabilities, not just with the direct costs with tariffs and quotas, but also the indirect costs with the paperwork and the processes that are involved in the middle and the back office. So the World Trade Facilitation Agreement of 2017 goes some way to do that, and some good efforts there. We get great guidelines being issued by the International Chambers of Commerce as to how to deal with paperwork, with documentary trade, and a whole host of other initiatives to really drive down that cost of trade, which, as I said earlier on, reports say that the lower the cost of trade, the more likelihood that trade will grow. Other considerations, though, to enable this to happen around the world at the same pace is obviously the legal work stream, the recognition of paper contracts and the veracity of those paper contracts when moving to a digital world, all at different paces, digital signatures, digital contracts, et cetera, all at varying level. And again, institutions and entities are trying to facilitate the recognition of those legal contracts around the world as well. In parallel to that, we do have an environmental concern, never been at the fore so much, and looking at the carbon footprint and where are these goods coming from? How are they being shipped? Is it responsible? Is it socially acceptable in the way that they are being distributed from the sourcing and the extraction all the way through distribution to the consumption from a retail point of view? And with that, we're then seeing technology enabling these processes to be digitized even further, available anywhere in the cloud, but there's so many clouds, how does one move data across those clouds? But then we also have now a much more of a savvy consumer, the ultimate consumer of these goods, of these products and services that are consumed once trade and trade finance methods and processes have been executed, who are now very much aware and conscious of where did these goods come from? Were they responsibly sourced? So with a much savvier consumer, with a whole host of technology moving at great pace, but the legal and the economic elements not falling in line from a political point of view with the environment, there's a lot of concern as to how will trade continue and can it continue? And as we said, how will GDP growth, especially with COVID, where the need for recovery is far greater. So these were the kind of things we were seeing last year and the year before, and the use of blockchain to enable processes to be more efficient and more collaborative, because everybody is connected in the supply chain in one shape or form, but the amount of trust requires intermediaries to facilitate the processes. And so last year, next slide please, Atul, we conducted a piece of research towards the end of last year. As I said, we published it last week, where it was a C-suite of 1,000 executives in 22 industries across 34 countries, all looking at, and all who were part of organizations that were more than $250 million in size and had been involved in blockchain strategy for the previous 3-4 years, and will be involved in the strategy and the use of blockchain in the next 3, 5, 7, and 10 years. And we got some pretty interesting insights from that. Next slide, please, that we'll share. And the timing of it, next one again, please. Thank you, Atul. We'll show how things are moving with blockchain. And we found that there were effectively, first of all, three types of organizations that were responding. The first is what we call joiners. These are organizations who just want to connect to a process within global trade or trade finance and consumer service as efficiently as it can. And as we know, blockchain introduces a whole host of efficiency to the process. For example, normal process, if it's a manual one, is 10 steps. You digitize it and automate it, apply technology, it should be cheaper, faster to consume. And you probably go from 10 steps down probably to about 6-7 steps, a 30% saving, basis for a business case, apply technology, and hopefully everything works a lot more accurately and efficiently. However, with blockchain, with distributed ledger technology, those 10 steps sometimes don't just go down to 6 or 7, they can actually go down to 4 or 5 steps because of the natural attributes inherent within DLT, with consensus, with smart contracts, with finality. So those elements of blockchain really introduce another level of efficiency. And we found that 31% said they just want to join a platform that is offering that kind of efficient service because they just want to get their cost of processing down. That's it. You know, my company, my process, it's offered more effectively somewhere else. Let me plug in and off we go. 18%, however, were what we call network builders. These are organizations, and these are organizations, not networks, responding to the survey. These are organizations that said, I want to come together with other companies who have a common process, and I want to then collaborate with them to build a much more efficient platform, which then we can all consume because we're all members of the supply chain in trade and trade finance somewhere, and then share that equally, and then get other people to come and join it, and then they will derive the benefits from it. So an example there is IBM. IBM is a company that listened to its clients, who then said, we need to have a much more efficient way to find provenance of our produce in the event that something gets contaminated in the supply chain. So IBM's biggest customers like Walmart, Kruger, all came together, like-minded companies, saying we want a common service, but we want to consume it in a much smarter, efficient, and trusted way, which blockchain gives you. IBM then is what you could term a network builder with Food Trust. However, 51% of organizations said they are network expanders. They're not there just to connect to consume. They're not there to collaborate to create a platform. They are there actually to have a mindset to actually co-create platforms such that although I have my platform, which is a use case, that use case is really only a slice of the whole workflow. And all the other use cases are all slices of the workflow. If you're a network expander, your mindset is, and this is what we were hearing from the companies responding, is to say, I have my platform and I have my slice of the workflow, which is my use case. However, I need it to interconnect upstream and downstream to not only get more efficiency, so I can be more competitive to compete and then try and increase the slice of my pie. But actually, what we're finding is that if you have that mindset, you have the opportunity to not only increase the slice of your pie, but the size of the pie too, with this thing called the network effect. And again, new organizations are being created, adding and creating new value, which increases the size. So for example, here, PharmaConnect. PharmaConnect is a company that has been created whereby it now provides an application based upon food trust, which shows the provenance of produce all the way from farm to fork, for example, coffee beans. And you now can have the application from PharmaConnect, which will actually then, you can zap onto your coffee, see where the grains came from, and then see, was this a fair sustainability? So these are the kind of profiles and personas we're seeing coming through from this global survey as to the types of organizations that are using blockchain to consume a service, to create a service, but then to collaborate to create more services and then grow the market size. Next slide, Zatul. And guess what? They're making money. Over 41% have actually said they are now seeing positive return of investments. And guess which countries are actually seeing some of these returns of investments? Obviously the US, but China. And China's been in the news with its efforts with blockchain to bring more trust and transparency into its economy and its country initiatives with the One Belt, One Road, and building national blockchain platforms to allow companies to come together and share data in a much more trusted and transparent way. Banking, electronics, IT, all leading industries as well. And they're seeing various sort of returns on their investments in blockchain because each one is measuring ROI in a slightly different way. And this is where it gets rather interesting in some of the data. Next slide, please, Atul. Because as you see, with the network joiners and the builders and the expanders, between now and the next 10 years, look at the shift you see in who is more profitable in their return investments today and who will be in the future. If I can just, so for example, if you look at it today, the network builders are by far the ones who are getting more ROI than the joiner and the expander. The expanders aren't there yet because it's a new mindset. Because with blockchain, you learn, you understand, you appreciate, you apply. And we're finding that companies are moving through that process. A classic example being, for example, HSBC. It was an organization that just wanted to consume services. Now you've seen with its investments in WeTrade, in Contour, it's now building networks. But as you now see from some of the news from HSBC, they're now looking to evolve that even further. And they now have more of an expansive sort of outlook to now say, well, I've got my investments. I would like now to try and find more ways of getting greater return on those. And so you see companies move through the joiner, builder, expander mindset that we captured within our piece of research. And you can see that come 10 years or even six is that the ones who are joining a network will now get more efficiencies because they'll be consuming more services through more people for their processes. But then the expanders will be getting the value as well. The ones in the middle who are building today, they will drop off because if you're just fixed into what you want to build for your own network and service for trade and trade finance, that won't be sustainable for the long term. You've got to think network of networks. You've got to think interoperability. So this shift of ROI is coming through. And again, some of the numbers with regards to GDP growth, they're forecasting, the 1,000 C-suite execs are forecasting anywhere between a 1% to 10% GDP growth if you have the trusted and transparent sharing of data across networks that have been created by various industries throughout the supply chain that have been financed by banks, but all within the whole trade supply chain. So there's money in the market. There are personas as to the attitude and the outlook for the money in those markets. And then should you be thinking to actually grow the size of your market, not just your slice of the pie, is what we were hearing loud and clear. So next slide, please, Atul. So let's now have a look at the way that these organizations see this happening. And that is in what we call chapter two, which is then the movement of data. Today, all of the categories regard between 76 to 86% saying that having trusted data in their supply chain, which gives accuracy and insights to then what gets financed for the banks then to have a better risk profile to then price in that risk with the right level of premium and not too much premium because they have to cover their risks. They all think that having that trusted data is important. But if you can see then, 38 to 57% don't want to share it, don't trust the other parties. And how, not only a case of don't trust the other parties to share the information, but also the fact that maybe data sovereignty requires that you cannot share the data or provide access or move that data if you did want to have that network of networks to then grow the size of the market and be more collaborative like a network expander. But then also if they were able to share, what we were hearing also very loud and clear through some of the research was that this notion of asymmetrical data, in as far as how do I know that if I share my data with you, and you share your data with me, we both derive value from that sharing of data. How do I know that you're still not deriving more value, making more money from my data than I am from you? And that psychological barrier is also slowing this whole growing of the market size, slowing new ways of collaborating and creating new business models and ecosystems because of that lack of trust in the relationship, as well as the lack of trust in that sharing of data. Because they all, 89% up to, say that if you can share data in the right way, with the right permissions, respecting privacy, then the value is there in the marketplace, as I said, with 1% to 10% GDP growth. Next slide, please. Thank you very much, Atul. So, and as this slide just sort of goes to expand on that, in as far as if you can share data in the right way, the opportunity to grow and find new source of revenue is high between buyers and sellers. And then if you are digitizing the method by which you're sharing data for trade and trade finance, then the asset itself, it becomes digitizable or tokenized. And we're seeing that in many markets and many core areas where tokenization of this assets is happening right now. And then if you can digitize and tokenize assets in a digital workflow with trust and transparency, then the reconciliation and settlement with digital currencies is a natural next step, which, as you know from the press, all of these areas are being discussed. But again, nobody is working collaboratively and in one direction for this introduction of trust and transparency to make markets more efficient, to help then GDP growth accelerate better, which with COVID-19 might be needed sooner because we are in and are in now and heading into some really dark days on trade and the economy. So how then can you drive growth? And then what we're hearing also is manufacturers, distributors, retailers are all keen to make sure that whatever goods flow and whatever is being financed through the supply chain, they have that optimum flow for the ultimate consumer. So the power of the consumer and the citizen is being recognized. And how do you get brand preference? To get that brand preference, you need to have provenance of the produce. Where did it come from? And then the transparency and the trust in that data So when somebody does do a scan of the QR code with their mobile phone of a coffee cup, they can then see that it was responsibly sourced. They can then see that the cobalt was responsibly mined for my electric vehicle or the batteries that are in my mobile phones. And as I said earlier on, next slide please, Atul, the returns are there. 1 to 10% GDP growth. What more could be more of a reason to bring more trust and transparency to global trade and trade finance in light of COVID-19 than that, those kind of projections of confidence of growth from 1,000 C-suite executives across 22 industries and 34 countries? So let's move on to the next slide, Atul. So how do you do this? How do you share this information within the marketplace? And then that really does lead us to technology. It is growing. We are in an economy where everything is available as a service anywhere, anytime. So cloud infrastructures, you've got multiple distributed ledger technologies, multiple blockchain technologies, capabilities out there. How will they be offered? And we have seen that, again, with our research, that 3 years ago, only 23% of organizations were working with one set of technologies to bring trust and transparency in the movement of data using blockchain. In 3 years from now, 85% say they'll be using more than one technology. So no one platform is going to rule the world. Standards are still way too early because adoption is still ramping up. So therefore, interoperability needs to occur. How it occurs still is open for debate. But rather than each technology platform saying it is the destination and it is Rome, it's too early to say all roads should lead to Rome if each vendor is promoting its platform independently. We all have to make sure we're all looking in the same direction and find our true north as an industry, and then ensure these things do come together as adoption rises and standards emerge. But for executives from 1,000 organizations, they then really do expect other parts of the ecosystem to be performing more of a role to help de-risk their investments in blockchain and other technologies to digitize processes, to get costs down, to raise GDP growth through growth of trade. And next slide, please, Atul. And that's where companies told us loud and clear, they expect different parts of the ecosystem to play different roles to help shape and provide those guide rails to companies to then overcome those delayed decisions on technology, knowing that digitization is happening. It does bring efficiencies, but they're concerned that they don't want to choose a platform, a cloud platform, for example, that locks them in. They need to know that they can go into any environment, no matter what they have. So the environment within which they will be operating and consuming services from has to be multi-cloud, has to be hybrid. The technologies, they have to interoperate. They have to share data in the smartest way and, you know, the most optimum way for what is needed for them. And that's where they expect governments and regulators to play a key role to provide those key guidance and input. They expect industry bodies to then help establish those marketplaces. Academia, interestingly, how academia and technology companies and market leaders in their space to increase the membership, having had governance being established, to then get everybody in the right space and time to work on those interoperabilities. Because if you can get the right marketplace established where everybody feels comfortable to connect in global trade, where trade finance services can be offered with the lowest risk, with the highest trust, with the lowest premiums, which makes working capital solutions more affordable, and where other parts of the ecosystems for logistics, tracking and tracing, provenance, all can come together and share services with the network of effect because they are all parts of the supply chain workflow, then they believe that if you can find a way to overcome that, then that growth opportunity would be there. And that's where it leads on to slide 16, which then says, maybe, Atul, next slide, please. Maybe there's an opportunity where there's a new way of sharing data. Atul, next slide, sorry. Oh, there we are, sorry, there we go. Is maybe there's a new way of sharing this data and how there's more of an open governance where common services are being offered. And common services, especially when you've got so many initiatives looking at KYC for onboarding, so many initiatives looking at digital identity. All that means is that you, as a company, as a consumer, as a participant in global trade, will have to choose one. Companies don't want to choose. They just want to choose and know that it will work. And therefore, why are many organizations double, triple, quadruple spending on the same capabilities? Why not have this available as a service to everybody, knowing that everybody, if they do go into the process of digitization, will need a digital identity? I need to know who you are. And then if we're going to do business with each other, I then need to know that you really are who you are with KYC. And then how do we settle if we do then buy and sell between each other? And then if we do, I need a method to know, is that product? Where is it in the supply chain? And then how do I find the best way to pay for it, whether it's digital, fiat, cryptocurrency, whatever the thing might be? How do we find a way where we can all convene in a marketplace that's neutral, where there's a natural incentive for people to come together? It's these kinds of outlook that we were hearing from our responses to the global survey of finding another way of doing something different to help bring more trust and transparency, which seems to be the missing piece when digitizing, when you're looking at global trade, to look at growth magnified as a result of COVID-19 at the moment, because the current efforts need to be enhanced. Doing the same thing and expecting a different outcome won't happen, as we all know. So we're in these times where we are hearing for global trade and trade finance that organizations now are expecting more leadership from its government, from regulators and the industry bodies to help them help themselves and the economy grow. And maybe blockchain is the capability that will allow the movement of that trust and transparency of the data to create not only market share growth, but market size growth as well. So next slide, please. Thank you. So here's a bit of an action guide that we offer as a result of this survey with regards to get your hands dirty. Remember, you have to learn, understand, appreciate, and then apply the technology as to the best way it is for you. But there is this whole notion of trust in the sharing of the data, which blockchain can give you. And then maybe there's ways that governments and regulators can come together, which are being topics that are being discussed with the ICC, the International Chambers of Commerce. They do have a digital working group looking at the digitization of trade finance, specifically using blockchain as well. And maybe there's other ways industry bodies can maybe come forward and provide greater guide rails and confidence for companies to come together and share the data to lower their costs, to then have a better opportunity to get GDP growth, especially in light of COVID-19. Now we're just shining a bright light on the fact that what's happening today is not good enough and it needs to be enhanced. Is there another way? And then how do we all change? So that's the pause, if I may, there at all on the sharing. Slide 18, next slide is the team that was working with us on this piece of research. Great team with Veena and Smita. And just the last two slides at all, just to cover our position in sharing some of these informations and with the appropriate disclaimers. But hopefully this was a useful insight as to how COVID-19 has shone a bright light on trade and trade finance, and how the need for trust and transparency is needed alongside digitization efforts to get those efficiencies in the market infrastructures for trade finance throughout the supply chain, and then hopefully provide that platform for greater GDP growth, which is needed sooner.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Pom. That was absorbing, to say the least. So I would go across and ask if anybody has any questions or comment. I do have mine, but I will ask towards the end. So open it up for anybody to have any questions or comment of what Pom talked about in the last 30 minutes. Any questions? Just unmute yourself and speak if you have any questions.
It was a very satisfying presentation, Paul. Full of insights.
And I think people could put the questions also into the chat group if they want.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there is a question from Soumya Chaudhary to Paul. Can you talk about track record of TradeLens?
Yes. How is the track record of TradeLens? How is the track record of TradeLens? I'm just trying to interpret that one. Can we?
What position is TradeLens at the moment? Where is TradeLens today? I think that's what you're asking, right?
Oh, TradeLens is currently TradeLens has got. I haven't got the exact numbers to hand, but it's got over 130 participants connected to the platform from customs authorities, port authorities, shipping companies. I think more than 60 to 65% of the world's container shipping companies are connected to the platform. It's generating or executing, I think, something like north of 2 million transactions a day in the access and the sharing of the paperwork used in the movement of a container. So TradeLens is doing great with regards to its platform as a service, which is one part of the workflow between a buyer and the seller, which is a tracking of the container for international shipments. And that's doing well. If you have a look at, say, for example, WeDockTrade, most of the haulage capacity and the track and trace is road in Europe, but there's talks, I think Mark is on the line here, Mark, I think, from WeTrade. Yep. There's talk again there to curate more value, Mark, with regards to driving more flow.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, absolutely. We've been already in discussions with TradeLens, so we know where they are. We see that there's a lot of value-added services to be able to put WeTrade and TradeLens and other networks collaborating together, because we've always said that no one network is going to rule the world. So we are very much open and already started discussions with TradeLens.
Thanks, Mark. Thank you.
Perfect. Thank you. I had a question. When with the data that you presented, the 41% return, music to my ears on the blockchain ROI, 46% of the CIOs says it is top of the priority compared to 23% 3 years ago. So would you say that we have crossed the chasm?
I'd say that, so the 41% at all was a surprise, but not a surprise. It was a surprise. It was not a surprise because we talked to organizations on their strategies for growth and how they can be as efficient as they can as they drive for top line growth. A lot of the companies we speak to under NDA have plans and do not declare those plans because there's competitive insights there. So I'm not surprised as to what was in the public domain. It was surprised to see 41% declare in the research that they are getting positive ROIs. So I think the ones, as I mentioned before, if you're a network builder, you're building for yourself this platform to provide common services to the immediate ecosystem. If you're a network expander, which is where over 51% were, they now have learned and appreciated the value of blockchain. It is a team sport, and their use case, the killer app, actually is just one slice of the workflow. So therefore, there's a natural tendency for people who now really appreciated the technology to realize it's a team sport. You will get greater value for you and your partners up and downstream in the supply chain from a cost and efficiency point of view, but actually grow the size of your market as well. So it was good to see, a surprise and not a surprise to see those numbers, but people are now declaring it because they're now more transparent because they need to share that data to grow, because business models are evolving as we speak.
Perfect. I do have a question. Between myself, Julian, and Andre, if you have to differentiate between the joiner, builder, and expander, what would be the characteristics that you would look upon in a target company to say whether he's a joiner or is an expander or is a builder? Any guidance or any thoughts on that would be really helpful.
Yeah, I think if we take why outlook to learning, you learn, understand, appreciate, then apply things. During that journey of that, and by the way, if I have a look at the conversations that we were having with our clients back in 2016, 70-80% of the conversations were all about learning and understanding blockchain. Now, 60-70% of our conversations are all about the appreciation and the application of blockchain to get market growth as well as the size of their slice of their market. So we've seen that conversation evolve, and therefore you don't just be a joiner or a builder or an expander, you evolve. So they're not mutually exclusive. You don't fall into one bucket or the other. It depends on your maturity and where you are in your own journey. And what is your business priority? And if your business priority is just take cost out, then you're just going to be concerned about joining and wait for somebody else to create something so you can consume as a service. But we are seeing people who've begun to understand and appreciate that actually I'm a builder. Let me build and in the right confines of regulatory compliance as well, as to how can we get more value from this between like-minded, interested parties. Very much like, again, sorry to go back to Mark with WeTrade, even with Contour as well, these are people who have a common process and they say, let's be most efficient and then see what happens, because then you become an expander and then you then evolve to say, well, actually there's more here if we start connecting. So it is a journey depending upon your knowledge and your risk appetite and your business priorities as to where you fall. But what we have seen with the latest survey is that even if you add the 18% who are network builders who see value, and then the 51%, you know, that's 69%. That's nearly 70% who are saying this technology has value where, you know, we're sharing data in a transparent, trusted, permissioned, private way. It's good for all of us. So let's all work together.
Perfect. A couple of questions in the chat. Let me read that out. So
there's another question.
So I'm just reading that out. What are the most popular use cases in banking, electronics, and IT for wide adoption of blockchain? Are these mostly on Hyperledger or Ethereum?
So there is rich data behind the research. And the immediate areas where people are most focused, C-suite executives, it's the cash positions and it's liquidity. And so the payments and reconciliations was a key area. How do I get my money working more for me throughout the supply chain? But then with that, then come, if you then link that to the digital tokenization of the asset, as well as the digital currency for payment, then you're talking micro servicing of settlements of goods throughout the supply chain to optimize working capital. So the use cases then go from payments and settlements to then where else within the supply chain where there's capital, process, or information intensity that I can optimize with the DLT capabilities within blockchain. So those use cases we can share more details on. There's there's rich data, but it's an evolving picture because each part of the steps within the workflow are attracting the technology, having gone to the low hanging fruit, which is all about liquidity. Hyperledger, Ethereum. I'd say in the early days, Ethereum was very much there just by maturity. Hyperledger then came through, obviously, 2015-ish. Corda, doing a good job, has done a great marketing job with the banks and has got 23, 26 banks, I think, as members as part of Marco Polo. And, hopefully, they get to market in a production way, because competition is good and that drives more innovation and creativity. But then the more decisions that have already been made by companies as to which technology platform they have selected, they're going to have to work together anyway. So everybody should be coming together in a much smarter way with interoperability.
Exactly. I think you already answered the full-on question. Yeah. So I think it makes sense in terms of just providing your comment on, Quorum versus CODA versus Ethereum versus IP Ledger. So does a joiner make sense as a strategy, or I guess you already provided the answer for that, right, Pam? If you want to just add one more line.
Yeah, there is one more question from Eugenio. What do you think about the activity World Economic Forum is providing in order to support open governance guidelines to structure blockchain solutions for enterprise?
Yeah, I think the World Economic Forum is doing a great job, and I think the work that it did last year, and I think it had a little bit of a, dare I say, a retweet this year as well. It's good stuff. It's toolkit. It's guidelines. But what we're hearing from our research and insights is industries need more than guidelines now. They need more than a toolkit. They need to be taught how to use the toolkit. They need to be guided and coached and trained in the adoption and the implementation of it. Because guidelines is great to provide some degree of guidelines and guide rails, but industry is saying they need more guidance. Not to be too prescriptive, but there's another way now that we should be collaborating. And that's where we're hearing that industry bodies maybe need to extend a little bit further for a digital world, for 21st century trade, above and beyond what they've done successfully for the last 100 years of trade. Because quotas and tariffs and guidelines were great for the last 100 years. For a digital world, it needs a little bit more hand-holding. So I'd say WEF, great. WEF, your audience is expecting more guidance to implement, not just issue guidelines for consumption.
Do we think though, Parm, that guidance is enough, or do we think that we also need policy changes to really help accelerate? Because we've been talking about trade finance for the last 150 years being, you know, paper based or even stone tablet based or whatever. Now we actually talk about blockchain, but before blockchain, we had, like, you know, other digital technologies. The policies have been somewhat slower, or they've been behind the curve. The technology has always been racing ahead, and we always say that with technology we can do everything, but sometimes we always have to then apply rules and conform to policies. So guidelines, yes. Sometimes I think it's more than guidelines we need. We need policy changes.
Yeah, so Mark, good point. You do need policy changes. So for example, law commissions are looking at the veracity of digital contracts versus paper. Every country in the world have their own law commissions, and they have their own interpretation and adoption of paper versus digital contracts, and all at varying stages of whether a digital signature is acceptable, or a PDF format, is a smart contract acceptable? Does it have the same veracity? So there are changes required from a legal legislation point of view, but that's not going to happen very, very quickly soon, because each country has its own processes by which to pass law. And it depends upon, obviously, the history and the implications of it. So each country is slightly different. So whilst countries are trying to catch up and do the right thing under the auspices of the World Economic Forum, the G20, the B20, the ICC, the WTO, etc., all good bodies doing the right thing, COVID has highlighted that it needs to get better sooner now, because we're in the depths of some pretty dire economic situations. So how then do you change? The change is then allowing for less risk of interpretation of the guidelines by industry participants, by then the regulators giving more firmer guidance. But then how do you adopt? And that's where industry bodies maybe can go a little bit further, because you still need, dare I say, a grown-up in the room anyway, just to supervise, to make sure things are happening in this marketplace that is neutral, so everybody is playing by the rules while all the countries are catching up. Mm-hmm. So there's a two-step process there, maybe I'd say, Mark, that whilst the legislation and countries are evolving and coming up to the common standards being promoted by the Trade Facilities Agreement, by the World Trade Organization, etc., and the ICC, is maybe there's another way to actually get there now, because even if those initiatives were executed to that capacity, you still don't have that trust and transparency in the movement of the data that makes the market grow to get GDP growth in the first instance, to get your costs right down.
Absolutely.
So maybe there's a way of doing something different. And that is a key thing with blockchain. And then can you imagine? I mean, I see Arnaud on screen as well. I mean, he did a great sharing of information last week about AI and machine learning. Can you now imagine the application of AI and machine learning on cleaner and trusted data for better insights, for even greater growth, rather than using the technology to get to a positive position of clean insights for growth? So if you had blockchain, it's a healthy platform upon which to then apply these technologies for even greater and then competitive advantage. But I think there's another way of collaborating now to compete again. And again, same like WeTrade, 12 of Europe's largest banks, fierce competitors by country and industry, came together on a common cause and now compete again. You're on a much higher efficiency level of a market infrastructure if you do it on WeTrade.
But I do agree with Mark, because we've been talking for some time about that with Andrea. We already have the guidance. If we say, for example, EUCP, which is a guidance about electronic documents, when we've seen the start of the COVID-19 crisis, everyone was a bit lost about how to handle electronic documents. Well, we already have the guidance. So I think Mark is right that we need actual policy, because the guidance are almost there already, and it's been created for years, if not decades now. It's just that it seems like no one is following them and no one used them when they actually could. So I don't really get why people want to have more guidance, new guidances about electronic documents, when we could already start using what we have in place.
So I know that's a good point. UCP
600. Point, sorry, Pat, for jumping in. We do have some sort of overstructure, which is UN, which tend to homogenize the legislation in several countries. So my feeling that now policy is over there, legislation is over there. So what we're missing now is just application. That's all. People should use the rules that were created. You know, it's a trade finance is well, let's say, regulated moment. So what is missing is, as Arnaud said, application of the existing rules and widespread knowledge of them.
I'd say, Andrea and Arnaud, isn't this a classic case? UCP 600, manual process, paper-based, LCs, et cetera, et cetera, bill of ladings, certificates of origination, et cetera. And then ICC, very quickly, I mean, normally, you know, it takes decades to change things. I think it was like 2 years. You then get to EUCP from UCP.
It was last year, actually. It was 2019.
Yeah.
The release of the UCP 2.0. It was last year.
Yeah, so here we go. UCP 600, EUCP, guidelines issued. Where is adoption?
It's nowhere. You know how many...
Evolves even further. But it evolves even further because COVID-19 comes in, and all of these, the guidelines are all about, like, you know, paper, signature, physical, you know, ink, wet ink, the whole lot. COVID-19 comes out and they come along and they say, okay, yep, because of the crisis, no contact, etc. Now we actually accelerate digital signatures, or we will now accept digital signatures. Because of a crisis or a pandemic or because of a chaos scenario, they're willing to accelerate policy or guideline changes. But we don't need to, again, it's more reactionary as opposed to being proactive in changing and evolving with the technology. That's my point.
Exactly.
Yeah, I'm also mindful of the time.
Exactly. But that's why also the ICC.
There is a question that has come up. We should handle that as well. There's a question from W3C from Matt. The W3C standards and other project governing digital identity and verifiable credentials. It's useful for KYC, but are you seeing participation or similar standards being worked on a global trade environment, if you know anything about that form?
I'm just reading that to understand the question again. In my case, it is useful for KYC. So, trying to answer this in the simplest way. There are many initiatives for KYC, for digital identity, for track and tracing, for provenance. There's so many initiatives out there looking to address this problem. Those people are looking to create a platform, and then you as a consumer will have to make a decision. Do I go to Atul's KYC? Do I go to Mark's KYC, Andrea's KYC, or Arno's KYC? I, as a KYC consumer, don't care. I just want to know that if I'm going to do business with somebody, that they are who they say they are, and they have been shown to be who they are, such that then if we do business, how then do we settle once we've exchanged those goods? There are loads of initiatives. What we're hearing from our research is people's decisions are being delayed to digitize because there's a dilemma on that decision, all the D's, in ensuring that they haven't made the wrong decision, be a vendor, because there's no standards yet. So until you get adoption, you know, typically how it would work, you get adoption, then see the patterns, then you'll get standards. Here with blockchain, here with trade and trade finance, we've got enough insights to know that we have to do things slightly differently, as with the example of EUCP and UCP 600, is issuing guidelines is not enough. And our survey and our research and the study is saying is companies expect more guidance and maybe another venue where they can go to, knowing that there is a natural incentive that it's safe in their decisions to connect, as well as people in that venue offering services and also then driving market growth. So it's a bit of a long answer to your question, but there are other initiatives. It is all coming together, but maybe we should all be looking at our own north for trade and trade finance, not just saying that our platform is the destination and road.
Thank you for that. There's another question from Joel about documents playing a key role in international trade to enable the adoption of digital document that is a missing link between the origination and settlement of trade. We need to be able to exchange those documents across different processing infrastructure. Have you looked at the solution in this area?
So there's many, so thank you for that. There's many solutions there, Joel. Again, it's the same thing. Everybody has a way of doing this. What we're hearing from our study is maybe there's a different way that we consume this service and how then those digital documents are recognized legally via a rule book, via a venue, whilst all the other countries are looking to change their laws and regulations with the adoption of digital contracts and digital signatures. So again, the countries are doing their best. Governments, obviously, there's that political dynamic. Industry said we have to do things different, and I'm now talking to their industry bodies. And that's where, you know, one of the slides, how do you create this marketplace and the role of regulators to establish government governance? How do you then drive participation with the industry leaders to give confidence to all of those participants up and down the supply chain? That's the way that we believe that things could evolve to give trust and transparency above digitization. Because again, let's not forget, guys, manual process is 10 steps. Digitizing it takes you to 6 or 7, but with blockchain, the efficiency goes down to 4 or 5. And with that sort of a lower cost, transparent sharing of data, that is what will motivate people to come and get that network effect.
Perfect. Thank you. You have a couple of more minutes, Pam, or you have a hard stop because there is one more question that maybe you want to take?
Just last question, that's all, because I also have to drop another meeting.
Yep.
Can you take one more question, Tom, or you have to go?
Just very quick last question.
Yeah, blockchain has received well-deserved attention, but do you see the resistance from the bank? If yes, will it change the canvas once banks start generating more value, financial and non-financial, from blockchain?
Blockchain has been received well. Banks, 90% of all of the conversations we were having in 2016 were with financial services institutions. And that was because of this notion of the intermediary being disintermediated. All I can say is that the banks have learned, understood, appreciated the value of blockchain, and they're now applying it in different ways. So I think that the banks have appreciated what it can do. I think the initial reaction that we saw was more defensive in its strategy, but I think they have realized the opportunity to grow market size as well as their market share and are moving forward more offensively in their strategy with blockchain.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Pom. I know it's 2 minutes over, but it has been really insightful. Yeah. And really, I learned quite a lot. And thank you for everyone for asking questions. And Pom, look forward to be a member of Provocative Trade Finance SIG. And look forward to joining you again 2 weeks from now for everyone. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye. Bye. Everybody.